This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Scientists have taken pictures of objects in the universe that are billions of light years away from Earth, but visiting those remote locations would be impossible. But still, we're stretching out further and further into the universe with probes. In today's program, we'll hear a report about last week's findings by NASA's New Horizons spacecraft, which performed a flyby of the most distant object ever explored by man, over 4 billion miles from the sun. We'll hear about what scientists are learning from this object and how it actually has a connection to your life. We're also going to talk about back pain. Did you know that 4 out of 5 American adults experience it? Some of them so bad that they lose functional control. We're going to have a conversation with personal trainer Jorg Mardian, who says there's quite a lot you can do about back pain if you address the real causes. And I'll conclude with a last word about how to build a better vocabulary. We're going to start, though, talking about your children. There are a lot of frustrated parents out there grappling with serious problems with their young children and their teenagers. We live in a landscape of changing families, changing social norms, changing ideas about how to bring up our children. There's a lot of advice out there, but the results are very mixed and in many cases terrible. Do you want some sound time-tested instruction on how to work with your children and teenagers? The Philadelphia Church of God has just published a new book called Child Rearing with Vision. It's already available online at thetrumpet.com, and the printed copies will arrive at our offices first week of next month. To talk about this here in the studio, we have the man who worked as the point man on this project, Dennis Leap. Hello there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh yeah, and congratulations to you. This is quite a nice project to be able to put a stamp of a finality on.
Yeah, it's done. Yeah, but it was a team effort. That's what's really exciting about it is there was more than one hands in this kettle of soup. So that was big.
So the title Child Rearing with Vision, what is the vision that is described in the title?
You know, it's actually very very practical and very simple, and people that read their Bible would get it really quickly if they just believe the Bible literally. And basically the vision is that God is a family. We have God the Father, we have Christ who is his son, and then Christ even you know, it talks about that you know, he came, he lived as a human, he died as a savior for all mankind, and then he was resurrected as a spirit being. And it says that he's the older brother of a lot of brothers to come. And so here, you know, God is a family, and so many human beings they're so caught up in the, you know, this theory of evolution. You know, they think human beings are actually animals, when really we might share the flesh with an animal, but it says very clearly in the Bible we're made after God's image or after his likeness. And so that's the vision, that here this is just one phase of the life of a human being, this physical life. There's a second phase, it's a spiritual phase. And so everyone, if you look at Christ as your example, everyone has the potential to be born or resurrected as a spirit being, as a son of God. And so that has to be, let's say, the underpinning or the, you know, the foundation of all child rearing is you're raising really future gods.
You're keeping your eyes on the horizon. What is the ultimate goal? What we're trying to produce here, and working with in a way that builds the character in them that is going to prepare them for that future.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you look at just Christ's life, I mean, what did they say about him? They said he went around doing good for others. You know, he didn't hate people. He didn't get upset and murder someone. He wasn't a thief. You know, he went about teaching what his father taught him. He went around doing good. He was healing people. Mm-hmm. He was very moral. you know, he was upright, but he was a robust guy too. I mean, he worked hard. He was a, you know, worked as a carpenter. Mm-hmm. And so the thing is those are all the basic things of life that we need to be teaching our children. You know, mm-hmm. you raise them to be, you know, do good for others. You raise them to be supportive of others. You raise them to be, you know, to help the weak, and you know, help raise them to want to make society better. That's mm-hmm. those are the basic principles.
So let's talk about the way the book is organized. You have three introductory chapters: Hannah's vision, fathers rule the family well, and then shape your child's human spirit. There's obviously a lot of meat packed into those first three chapters. Then you have chapter four, rearing your young children, newborn to age five. Chapter five is rearing children aged 6 to 12. And then chapter six, rearing a moral teen. And then a chapter on preparing teens for adulthood. So it's very much directed at trying to help parents to access the information they need that is relevant and practical for right where they are at that stage in their child's development.
Exactly. The thing that we've asked people to do at the very introduction was to read the whole thing first to get the big overview.
Yeah.
And then they could go into the section that might be most appropriate for them. But there are certain things in, like, say, the newborn to age five. There are some basics that a lot of families have missed.
And well, that's true.
And some of you may have to go back and just rebuild again. But the thing is, what we really worked for is, I mean, if you think about, you know, every family is different. Every family kind of has a personality, you know, but then every child is different. And so the real struggle with this was to figure out what to give people that everyone could take advantage of.
Yeah.
And so we kind of went to a core. What's the core of what you could give them? And then the whole idea behind the book is that there's going to be a time when you're going to need to counsel with someone. And so you know, we did talk to a lot of young families. You know, what did they want to see in the child rearing booklet? Mm-hmm. You know, we talked to, of course, you know, we had some field ministers involved in it, and what, you know, the kind of the issues they're dealing with right now. And so it all worked together, and I think we did get down to a core. Mm-hmm. But there's obviously going to be more questions, you know, that come
sure.
up.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, but the idea being you address the main principles, the pillar pillars that have to be in place as you're dealing
exactly.
with children of different ages.
Right.
Now, there's a chapter in the book, the first chapter from Gerald Fleury. There's a chapter, well, there are two chapters in there from Herbert W. Armstrong.
Right.
You also have a lot of quotes from the old Plain Truth About Child Rearing booklet. So there's clearly a lot of this material that is built on what the church has taught over the years on this subject. Maybe you could just talk about how that past teaching formed the foundation.
Well, the thing is, I don't want to sound, you know, vain or arrogant here, but when you know you're right, you want to share it with others. And, you know, we grew up in the church. I mean, my wife and I, we were just newly married, had our first child. We didn't know what to do with child rearing.
Yep.
You know, we came into the church under, you know, Mr. Gerald Fleury, basically, and he already had two children, and we watched him. But we also read the booklet. But the point is, we studied him, and we watched the success he had.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we wanted to imitate that success. And I think you know, and if you look at, you know, having four daughters and now having 10 grandchildren,
mm-hmm.
we know these things work. And,
right.
and it works well. And there's a lot
of... even just more broadly within the church, it seems that if those who have worked to apply the principles, and there have certainly been folks who have misapplied or
right.
Not used it correctly, but there is a track record there.
But it is Bible-based. I mean, this booklet is definitely Bible-based.
Yep.
We go back to it. And even Garner Ted's book, you know, I guess we call it Garner Ted's, but I'm sure Mr. Herbert Armstrong obviously approved it. But that was Bible-based as mm-hmm. well. But like you said, I mean, every human being, you can read the Bible and misapply it. Look at the whole world.
Sure.
How many people are misapplying it.
Yep.
And the thing is I think we have enough in there to warn against misapplying,
mm-hmm.
you know, what's what you're doing with children, and I think it's going to be very beneficial.
What when you think of the overall product, and you think of all of the different bits of information that are put in here, obviously there's a whole lot packed in. There's also a lot that you weren't able to pack in. Right. We'll talk about that a little bit, but are there pieces, like, just to get to some specifics, some examples of the valuable instruction that parents would find in here that you'd share?
Now, I think there's like maybe I could start out quickly with two or three big ones that I think are important. One is, I think that the book really emphasizes the parental responsibility in child rearing, and it's a lot about teaching. It's a lot about teaching the child and spending time with your child. And really, the whole thing about, you know, what you get with evolution, and, you know, they want to talk about instinct. And I've even read books, you know, where child rearing books where they talk about a baby being an animal. Well, there's basic instinct. Now, a little baby would, you know, cry to, you know, because they're hungry, or they, you know, a young child will work to protect itself. Those are instinctual. But mostly everything else, you have to teach a child. Mm-hmm. You have to teach them to eat, and certainly you have to teach them to eat with etiquette. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you have to teach them how to take care of themselves, you know, wash themselves, and, you know, if they get cut, how to, you know, prevent more infection. Those things all have to be taught. And if you believe a human being is an animal, you think, well, they're just going to instinctually know how to do that. They're not. Mm-hmm. So but then when you get into morality and you get into the big issues of, you know, obeying laws and being under authority, all those things have to be taught. A child is just not going to naturally say, hey, well, I love your authority, mom and dad. Let's just go with it.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So but the other thing I think is so important, and it's critical, is I think it's our 85-10-5 formula.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, child rearing is all about love. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to love your child. And, you know, that's where, if you really do love your child, then you're going to do the teaching. If you really love your child, you're going to take the time. And if you understand that vision, if you're preparing a child where they can, you know, have the creative power of a God, or they can have the rule that a God would have over a planet or in the universe, you want the best for that child. You're going to work harder to teach that child.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, give them the experiences that they need.
Yeah.
Child rearing is more than just, well, spanking. It's about, well, here's this child. They have this talent. So you get them these experiences, or they have that talent. Or maybe they need a little help in growing in an area, maybe in sports, where you encourage them to do sports, even if they may not be as sports-minded.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the love comes in. And then, of course, 10% teaching. And then really, when you say the word discipline today, it's like they want to get the police after you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but discipline doesn't always mean spanking.
Yeah.
And there may be a time for spanking, but, man, that's a last resort. You know, it's like at a 5% level.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some people think when you talk about disciplining children, you're like, you know, talking about that's 85%. That's not really true.
Right.
I think that's a phenomenal teaching that this book brings out.
If you could briefly explain, you were talking earlier about just how there's so many different kids, there's so many different issues that kids face. You really tried to boil it down to the basics. Talk about the sidebars and the for further reading at the end that helped to try to give a little bit more of the complete picture without expanding it beyond, you know, the size that we could handle.
Right. I think that's really kind of a unique part of the book is the sidebars and the for further reading. Because once you read the whole thing, a lot of those sidebars are great references. You know, like we even have one in there, you know, teaching about, you know, firearms. So even when we talk about, you know, the firearms, there's really a balance in there. It's not like the hot issue that it is out in the world. It's really balanced. There has to be a balance with it. You know, there's one other of my favorite sidebar is the Bible on spanking. Mm-hmm. You know, we listed all the scriptures out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, But again, it's still based on love. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's the, I guess one of my favorite scriptures is, you know, he who spares the rod hates his son. Mm-hmm. Now, that's tough for a lot
of people.
That's a
challenging, to really get the depth of what that's saying. Yeah. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, but then when you look at the further reading, that's how we packed everything else in.
Uh-huh.
And it's really great because there's so many articles will be written by you, by Mr. Stephen Fleury. I think we tried to put in just about every article that Mr. Ron Fraser wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's all for further reading. They can get that at pcog.org. We're organizing it all, so it's going to be easy for them to find.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully, as some new questions come up, we're going to be able to put some new stuff up on pcog.org, too. So I don't think this is the end of it all. I think it's just a really great foundation for all of us to use, and then we'll build on it as we go.
Outstanding. Well, we've been talking with Dennis Leap about the Philadelphia Church of God's new book, Child Rearing with Vision. This book is now available for free download online at thetrumpet.com. You can check it out under the Literature tab. If you want a printed copy, email us at pcgmail@pcog.org. pcgmail@pcog.org. The book is scheduled to start mailing first week of February. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The universe around us is full of mystery, in no small part because it's so far away and it's so difficult to study. But scientists gained a bit more knowledge about it in a recent rendezvous with a distant object out beyond the edges of our solar system, as we'll now hear in this report from Richard Palmer.
During the first few hours of 2019, NASA's New Horizons spacecraft performed a flyby of the most distant object ever explored by man. 2014 MU69 is a chunk of ice or rock over 4 billion miles away. NASA nicknamed the object Ultima Thule, after the Latin term meaning beyond the borders of the known world. And it's an apt name. The New Horizons spacecraft's previous big splash was its flyby of the unimaginably distant dwarf planet Pluto in 2015. And yes, I'm going to say that scientists were right to downgrade Pluto from being a planet. Bring on the hate mail if you disagree. But anyway, now the New Horizons probe is another billion miles further out into the remote ring of ice and rocks known as the Kuiper Belt. Ultima Thule will be the first object within the Kuiper Belt to be studied in detail, not including Pluto. And to me, it's been thrilling just to have this object that we know so little about, and then to start to get more and more details of pictures of it. On December 31st, all we had was this vague smudge, our best guess at what it looked like. Now we know that it looked like a big pink snowman in space, without the carrot for the nose. And a lot of that data is just going to keep pouring in. It's almost like reading reports from some of the early explorers visiting new continents for the first time. So much about this mission is hugely impressive. Scientists discovered Ultima Thule in 2014, and in about a year discovered enough about it to predict exactly where it would be on January 1st, 2019. And New Horizons began changing course to head to Ultima Thule in the autumn of 2015. But there's something even more impressive about Ultima Thule. Its connection to you. Ultima Thule is part of a huge number of objects in the outer reaches of the solar system. Over the last century or so, astronomers have come to gradually realize that our solar system is surrounded by really several massive clouds of debris. The Kuiper Belt is the smallest and closest of these debris clouds. in the outer reaches of the solar system. The Oort cloud is much larger and much, much further away. It stretches from around 100 billion miles from the sun to 10 trillion miles. As a reminder, as distant as Ultima Thule is, that's only 4 billion miles. Now, this Oort cloud stretches 100,000 times further than the distance between the Earth and the sun. And there could be up to a trillion objects orbiting the sun in that Oort cloud. Now, scientists' model of how this solar system forms, those models don't predict anything close to that amount of debris. Where it all came from, they don't really know. And this is part of the reason why scientists are so excited about the Ultima Thule flyby. They hope that it will shed light on how the solar system was formed, why there are so many of these shattered rocks and shards of ice. But scientists aren't the only ones who can get excited about this. Herbert W. Armstrong, the founder of our predecessor magazine, The Plain Truth, he also got excited about NASA missions. On the 20th of July, 1976, for example, he arrived at Ambassador Auditorium just before 5 a.m. so he could see the first pictures arrive from the surface of Mars sent by the Viking 1 probe. And when he saw those pictures, he described how they showed exactly what he expected to see. He wrote that, "I had to realize that from this scientific laboratory right here in Pasadena, great minds are in fact uncovering facts already revealed in the book they do not understand and probably do not accept. The revealed facts and truths of the eternal living God." Romans 8:21 tells us that the creation, the whole universe, is in bondage to decay. That's why Mr. Armstrong was excited to see those Mars photos. He wrote that, "You can realize the thrill I experienced seeing in our own House for God auditorium the first real close-up photographs from the very surface of Mars, confirming the state the Bible reveals such planets are in today." And the New Horizons mission confirms this on an even greater scale. You know, it's not just one or two planets that are subject to this kind of decay. Our entire solar system is surrounded by this mind-numbingly huge cloud of debris and destruction on a scale that we just can't imagine. The Bible tells us, though, the origin of the universe. It explains the origin of all of this decay. And the same passage in the Bible tells us how and when this decay will end. Verse 21 of Romans 8 states that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and obtain the glorious liberty of the children of God. The universe will finally be free of this decay when God's people, his church, are born as his sons. And Romans 8 describes the whole universe yearning for this time. Hebrews 2 in verse 8 tells us that at this time, all things will be put in subjection to man. In Hebrews 1, it uses the same term, all things, when it does it there. The Moffat Bible translates that as the universe. That's what's really meant by all things. The universe is going to be put into subjection unto man. All things, the Kuiper Belt, the Oort cloud, far beyond, far, far, far beyond. That will all be put into subjection to man. And really, in the grand scheme of the universe, the Oort cloud isn't really out of our front porch, let alone in our own backyard. But at that point, when it's subject to man, that's when this decay will end. We will have the awesome responsibility, and I mean awesome literally, not in the kind of American way of meaning quite nice, but awesome literally, responsibility of cleaning up all of that decay. Now that vision is why Mr. Armstrong went to Ambassador Auditorium before 5 a.m. to look at pictures from a dead planet. And the Bible is full of scriptures describing that vision. God says in Isaiah 51 and verse 16, for example, that he intends to plant the heavens. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, he wrote that God is going to undertake a massive building project out in the cosmos to make the universe exquisite. Do you really believe that? God is going to extend his government throughout the universe. He is going to give you the opportunity to help him plant the heavens. God is right now preparing people to be born into his family. These people will help clean up the decay and the destruction in the universe and beautify it. That's why these pictures from NASA can be exciting for all of us. Mr. Flurry also wrote, "When we hear stories like Gene Kernan's, that was the last astronaut to walk on the moon, and view pictures of the universe, our future among the stars becomes more real to us. Right now, the universe is in a state of decay. We will soon change that. And these missions, the pictures from these missions, the pictures that we're still going to be getting back over the coming months in more and more detail from Ultima Thule, they can help that make that future more real to us. And you can gain a greater vision of that future with our full-color booklet, Our Awesome Universe Potential. It will show you why the universe is presently in a state of decay. It will take you through in detail what the Bible says about your future in that universe. And it's full of pictures and facts to really make that vision come alive and painted in beautiful full colors. You can order that book at our website, thetrumpet.com. Just go at the top right-hand corner and click on the library tab there. And you can read it online, you can download it. And we're more than happy to send you your own free copy as well. So please do get that and take a look at our book, Our Awesome Universe Potential.
Well, thank you for that, Richard. Really fascinating subject here. This chunk of ice we're talking about is over 4 billion miles away. Can you just talk about what an extraordinary engineering feat this was to cause this flyby to happen?
Yeah, there's so much about this that was just incredible. So, you know, it was a huge achievement for the New Horizons probe to make it to Pluto, this dwarf planet, this small planet. Ultima Thule isn't a dwarf planet. It's about 21 miles across. It's tiny. That's kind of even small for a city.
Uh-huh.
Even finding this thing, 4 billion miles away is pretty incredible. And that took a lot of work. They then had to direct the New Horizons probe. You know, they had to get it all steered and pointed in the right direction in 2015. So they had to calculate exactly all the way back in 2015 where Ultima Thule was going to be on January 1st, 2019, and just to get that right. And then, of course, the New Horizons probe itself is traveling insanely fast. I mean, it's gone 4 billion miles. You don't travel 4 billion miles by moving slowly. And by the time it got to Ultima Thule, it was going past Ultima Thule at a speed of 32,000 miles an hour.
Uh-huh.
And so if you imagine you're going past a 21-mile-long lump of rock at 32,000 miles an hour, you've got an infinitesimally small time, you know, a fraction of a second to kind of take photographs of it, to get all of that data in, and then, boom, you know, the chance to get any of that data is gone forever because it is way behind in your rearview mirror very, very quickly. And then just even, you know, in planetary scales, trying to get close to something that's 21 miles across is pretty incredible. You get out by a few hundred thousand miles. That's a pretty small distance when it comes to distances in space, but that would make a pretty huge difference to the ability to photograph this thing. So to be able to rendezvous with such a tiny object so far away is just incredible.
So you mentioned in your report that all the debris in the Kuiper Belt doesn't match scientists' models of how the solar system formed. And there, obviously, they tried to collect as much information as they could in this infinitesimally small amount of time that they had to do so as they passed by. But what are they hoping to learn from this close look that they got here in terms of the origins of the solar system and matter, and what have they learned in these couple of weeks since that happened, or I guess it's been about a week that it's happened, that will help them?
So in terms of what they hope to learn, if you're looking at the solar system as something that, you know, through kind of stellar evolution, the stellar lens of something that kind of gradually coalesced together, and that you once had just this debris of dust and bits of it condensed down to form a star and some of it condensed down to form a planet. These very distant rocks are kind of the leftovers from that those early days of the universe, that of the solar system. That's the way that the scientists are kind of looking at it. And so this is one of those bits that didn't form a planet. that didn't get sucked into any of the other ones. It's then it's therefore in a much more pristine condition. You have a chunk of rock forms a planet, it's going to get burnt and melted, and there's not much you can learn about it. So the thinking was that this would be something in pristine condition from the early days of the formation of the universe. We can study, or with the solar system, we can study it and learn what the solar system was like at the time that planets were forming, or even before. In terms of what has happened, I mean, this is another thing that I think just drives home the scale of the distances involved. What have we learned? So far, it's basically we've got some much more detailed pictures. Before the trip, we didn't before this flyby, we didn't really even know what it looked like. It might, Ultima Thule might have been two objects. Mm-hmm. They weren't orbiting each other. They weren't even sure about that. We've got the picture now, but now we're the other side of the sun from Ultima Thule and the probe. So the probe had to take a week off broadcasting. It couldn't get through to us, and then it's going to take months of broadcasting for it to send all of its data back.
I see.
The internet connection between here and the Kuiper Belt is worse than it is in a rural village somewhere, and it's going to take it an awful long time to download the data. So I think we probably will, in the weeks ahead, start to have some, hopefully, if everything went right with all of the photos, some even more detailed images than we have right now, similar in quality perhaps to some of the ones we had of Pluto. That some of those pictures were a bit of a long shot, but hopefully we'll have some of those really detailed pictures. And then I think some of that data is going to take more time to analyze. But I think they were hoping to get some scientific papers out within a month or two. So I guess they probably are working on the data already. But I think the latest press conference with the data was January 3rd. And that ended up being kind of light on data and mostly just more pretty pictures.
Yeah. So to be continued. We've been talking to Richard Palmer about NASA's recent flyby of Ultima Thule. He wrote a blog post about it, A Glimpse Beyond the Borders of the Known World. You can read that on thetrumpet.com. He also mentioned that full-color booklet, Our Awesome Universe Potential, and that explains what the Bible says about the universe and your future. And that's also available for free at thetrumpet.com. We really appreciate that, Richard. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
If you've ever suffered from low back pain, you know how excruciating, even debilitating, it can be. And you join 80% of American adults, many of whose back pain is so bad they lose functional control, they can't enjoy activities, they can't work. But according to personal trainer Jorg Mardian, back pain isn't as unavoidable as you think. To get past the suffering, you need to address the real causes. And we have him to talk about this from his office in British Columbia. Hello, York.
Hello there.
Let's talk about the way that modern medicine addresses back pain. How do they approach the problem?
Well, there's the rub. It's a backwards solution, really. Again, medicine tends to look at the effect rather than the cause. So they do tend to say that they have the solutions to the problem, you know. But the thing is, the solutions can kill you. I mean, we're looking at a lot of these prescriptions that are given out now. They're from opioids, mm-hmm. and they're a very powerful class of prescription drugs. But the fact is that they're actually very addictive.
Right.
And they can kill people as a side effect, and it happens a lot. And so you have a lot of complications ending up in mortality. And surgery is another thing that a lot of people go for. And now why do people believe doctors? So, you know, like it has a very poor track record.
Yeah.
But what they do is doctors tend to look at the spine abnormality through x-rays and such, and they have physical evidence that you can see. So we're looking at a spine and we say, well, you have wear and tear, you have, you know, abnormalities here, and you need this solution. And it's people accept that explanation without question because they have something in front of them. But there's a lot of hoping and wishing and continual suffering in this solution that they give you. And it's an antiquated system that doesn't look at the cause. You know, there is a real cause, and there is a viable solution to back pain.
So you talk about how doctors, so they can take an x-ray and they can point to the abnormalities, and that's really common. I remember I heard a lecture from a man who coaches powerlifting, and he was talking about how just about any spine you look at, you know, in anybody in their 30s and up is going to have something in there that doctors would be able to say, well, see, there you go. We need to do something about this. What is it about the lower back that makes it so susceptible to pain?
Well, and that's a good question. And just getting back to your first point, which is a really, really good point. You can look at any spine and see wear and tear.
Yeah.
It's not the actual wear and tear. I mean, a lot of that is normal wear and tear as we go through life. I mean, we age and we can feel it, you know. But if you look at the spine, the cervical spine, the upper spine of the neck, it's more delicate and fragile because there's a lot of movement there. But the lumbar spine, the vertebrae of the lower back, now that supports the structure of the upper back. And it also gives movement, but we can compromise the durability of that through what we do. So I have a lot of clients that are 300 plus pounds. Mm. That's a lot of wear and tear on the spine.
Right.
There's a lot of jobs out there which are excessive movement, excessive weight that we use, you know, improper movement. There's a lot of people that are inactive and that have weak posture, weak muscles of the midsection. And so that causes these vertebrae to misalign. It's sort of like if you stack blocks on top of one another, your spine, if you can imagine that. And if one of those goes to the side and misaligns, then we get pain. Mm. You know, so it's an amazing structure, to spine, but once we mess with it through excess of any sort, then we tend to have problems. Now, another thing that we can look at is, as you know, and you've written about this as well, is posture. Mm. Posture is big. And how you carry yourself is really a snapshot of the health of your spine. If you look around you, you see a lot of people with that forward head posture.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's uneven hips, standing on one foot unevenly. I mean, it's just crazy. People don't understand how they look. So your neck, it might ache today, but your posture in 10, 20 years might become give you chronic pain due to all these reasons that I've stated. And another big one that we see is technology. I mean, I can't state that enough. I watch kids even here in my studio, and they're waiting for their mothers, and they're hunched over a phone for hours.
Yep.
I mean, absolute hours. And the end result is we're inactive and we're hunched over a desk or some type of technology, and it decreases our motion. It brings about dysfunction of the spine, disc disease, and deterioration, what doctors see. And a lot of that actually is accelerated today in the last 50 years. I mean, if we look back to the records through time, we don't see a lot of that on record. Hmm. People were really a lot more robust than they are today. But if you go back the last 50 years, you start to see an alarming increase in back pain. You know, this industrialization and the easing of jobs and the sitting posture that we have.
So if I can interrupt you for a second, you said the fact that our jobs have gotten easier has actually contributed to the deterioration of spinal health.
Absolutely.
So in other words, there's a benefit in, say, having a certain amount of load bearing or activity in terms of spine health.
Yes. Yes. We're made to move. We're not made to sit. In fact, you know, there's so many.
The thing that what's interesting about that is you tend to think, I think it would be common for someone to think that it's the job where you're carrying burdens and that type of thing, that would be what would cause overstress on the back. And I suppose that it would if you were doing that improperly. But what you're saying is that the sedentary, the lack of putting the spine under stress in that way is actually just as bad, if not worse.
It's probably a lot worse. Mm. So if I've done, in my past, I've done heavy jobs, heavy lifting, and I understand that it can cause a lot of problems. But throughout my life, I've always kept fit as well. So I've tried to make sure that my body stays strong to be able to meet the demands of the job. and I've tried to pay attention to how I move throughout the job. So I do very little in movement without thinking. Mm-hmm. If I take a step, if I bend, if I move sideways, I think ahead. And it's just an automatic thing for me already to protect my body. And a lot of people don't think like that. So if you're in construction, yes, that job is good for you. And it's very protective of the spine if done properly.
If done properly. I would imagine that there would be listeners out there who would say, yeah, it was the construction job that caused my back pain. And that really comes down to maybe going through those motions, picking up the sheets of drywall or the roofing tiles or whatever it is, and doing it in a way that puts shear on the spine or that creates problems, as opposed to moving in a way that strengthens.
Right. So I've lifted a lot of drywall in my life, and you carry it on one side of the body.
Yeah.
You have to prepare yourself for that lift. You know, you have to lift with the knees. You have to be able to brace your core properly to bring that drywall up. You lift it up on one end, and then as you go up, you make sure that you brace your body.
Yeah.
And as you're walking now, you have to think ahead. Is there anything in my path? Can I stumble on anything? Is the door open where it was closed before and I'm going to run into it or something foolish like that? I mean, it sounds kind of silly when we're talking about it, but it happens so much. I mean, think of the classic one on a construction site where somebody walks through an open manhole.
That might cause some back pain.
It happens because people don't think ahead. Or you stumble over a rock on a construction site. That happens a lot. Or any object, a piece of wood that's thrown carelessly aside. Mm-hmm. Something like that. So brace the body, make sure you know where you're walking, you know, think ahead. So these are all forceful movements. We have a great weight. And then if we do stumble and walk forward, even there, if you're strong, if your core is strong and you stumble with a load, you can actually do a lot better with that, bracing yourself and preventing injury, than somebody who has a weak core on a construction site.
Yeah.
Who will get hurt.
Well, I have several questions. We probably have more questions than we have time to address, but, for one, maybe if you could answer this quickly, in my experience in teaching the physical education class at Herbert W. Armstrong College, we talk about, say, learning how to deadlift, for example, and you learn how to lift in a way that your body is working with the weight and you're protecting your spine. I mean, protecting the spine is pretty much the ground zero, most important thing you have to do when you're picking up a heavy weight. A construction worker, I've talked to construction workers who say, you know, they're dog tired at the end of a day. They're doing so much physical activity. You know, where do they find the time, say, to train those and be picking up heavy weights or that type of thing? Do you address that at all, say, with the clients that you're dealing with? I would imagine most people who are actually signing up to participate in a gym are more of the sedentary types who are trying to get some kind of activity. Those who have physical activity in their job, maybe less inclined to do that. But do you have a solution for that?
Well, I can tell you there's no easy solution.
Yeah.
I used to work for months and months and months on construction sites, as many days as possible, 12-hour days when I was younger. I would come home and I could barely see straight.
Yeah.
And knew the next day I had to go in early when it was still dark. Now, my choice is, how do I eat? And how early do I go to bed?
Yeah.
Now, I have to force myself. I know what's good for me. And I know what I do, despite what my body wants me to do, is good for me. So I would take the time to have the good nutrition to feed myself. And then I would take the time to go and still exercise within my limits and what I could do, and then still get enough sleep to be able to get up the next day. And that's really the only way that I could keep going at that length of time.
Yeah. So you're talking about the kids hunching over their smartphones, and a lot of times, say, the deterioration in the spine takes place over a long period. If you could just tell us, what's the prognosis for someone who wants to correct those things? How do you prevent or remedy the back pain that you have?
Right. So, I mean, we have to try it and true. We look at the posture and we say, you know, sit properly and stand properly. When we're told to sit or stand erect, we hardly see that in anyone. I mean, it's a simple, simple thing. But if you sit at a desk and you slouch, or you stand and you slouch, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the most basic, common thing we can do. Make sure everything's lifted up. Make sure you're looking ahead. Make sure your head is not tilting forward. Mm-hmm. You know, I even sit with when I sit, I try to make sure I'm sitting back most of the time to not get that ache in my neck. And that's your first indication that you're sitting with a poor posture. And then the other thing is, make sure that you have exercise. Surprisingly, there's not a lot of studies that prove that exercise prevents back pain. I was really surprised with that. Hmm. But common sense tells us that anybody who exercises has stronger muscles, tendons, and ligaments that support the structure of the body and that help with the rotation and the movement and the bending. I mean, if you see somebody that's fit, they're going to have less back pain unless they're being excessive, right?
Right. The man that I was talking about earlier, this is what you'd probably say is exactly the opposite of what you would hear from a lot of doctors. Well, you've got back pain. Well, you definitely don't want to be lifting things. You want to give your back as much rest as possible. This man that I was talking about said he hasn't seen a situation where someone had back pain that it wasn't actually correctable through deadlifting and squatting.
Well, I'll agree that a lack of exercise is probably one of the primary causes. And the more that you exercise your especially your backside, say your glutes and your hamstrings and your back, if you can do those, you know, 2 to 3 times a week, you're going to see problems disappear because atrophied muscles cause a strain in the back. So your doctor's telling you to rest, but that causes the opposite effect. And it causes, you know, your pelvis to tilt forward. It causes weak back muscles, increases the load on the spine because you don't have that support. And then you have unnecessary disc compression. It's a cascading load of effects that the doctors don't really understand. Mm. So I'll actually get correction from my clients that their doctors say, no, don't listen to him. He's wrong. Mm-hmm. And I'm on the other side of the spectrum saying, no, this is actually what I do for a living. And I see the effects of it all the time. It's actually good for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it probably is worth mentioning that before anybody started picking up heavy things, that it's just super important to learn how to do it the right way. There's definitely a way where you can protect your spine and strengthen your spine, and then there's a lot of ways that you can do it that make it a whole lot worse, but it's worth getting some coaching on that to learn how to do that properly. We've been talking with Jörg Mardian about how to manage and avoid a back pain. Keep your eye on thetrumpet.com for an article from him on the subject. Jörg, as always, very interesting. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Did you know the average person uses between 1,000 and 1,200 workable words in his lifetime? And we make up over 50% of our normal talk, recycling only about 100 words. Meanwhile, William Shakespeare in his plays used about 22,000 different words. Language represents thought. Elevated language represents elevated thought. The nobler our thinking, the nobler our language, and the more we strive to exalt our language, the more we ennoble our thinking and our being. In a book called It's the Way You Say It, Carol Fleming talks about a common habit of using empty superlatives like coolest or greatest, and empty intensifiers like really, just, and so. Here's an example she gives. We just loved our trip to Europe. It was really fantastic with all the sights and stuff. It's just so beautiful, you know. Terrific food and everything. She says this is empty language. And the reason is, like empty calories, it provides no substance but lots of emotional energy. But contrast a statement like that with an example like, the Serengeti was hot, dry, and enormous. We saw tens of thousands of gnu and zebra in migration. We slept in tents, so it was easy to hear the lions roar at night. I'd go back in a heartbeat. You can see how the second conveys so much more information. And she says intensifiers like very and superlatives like coolest, they do have a place in our communication, but it's a matter of quantity and appropriateness. She says the less you use them, the more meaningful they are. If something relatively common can get you to use terrific, it indicates that your range of experience is limited. Building a robust vocabulary gives you more options for expressing yourself. with color and precision and interest. One excellent communicator, Herbert W. Armstrong, set a terrific example of effective vocabulary use. He said that one of his main literary influences was a man named Elbert Hubbard. Hubbard was an excellent writer, and he possessed a massive vocabulary. And Mr. Armstrong said, well, he wanted to outdo Elbert Hubbard's vocabulary. He boasted that it was even bigger than Shakespeare's. Mr. Armstrong wrote in his autobiography, to be able to pour out a torrent of big words incomprehensible to any but the highly educated had appealed to intellectual vanity. But he had a boss at the Merchants Trade Journal who encouraged him to change that thinking. He said, when you write advertising, the purpose is not to impress the readers with your superior vocabulary. Your purpose is to sell goods, services, or ideas. The purpose of words is to convey thoughts, facts, ideas, a message. He said, don't talk to the 2% highly educated. Speak to the 98%. Mr. Armstrong said, we all have three vocabularies, our speaking, our writing, and our reading or listening vocabularies. A lot of people can understand many words that they wouldn't necessarily use. And there are even a lot of words that are uncommon, but they can be understood in context. So he said, immediately, my vocabulary underwent an overhauling. Deliberately, I began dropping out of my speaking and writing vocabulary all the big words not in common usage. My effort then became that of developing the ability to use the largest variety of words readily comprehensible by most people when heard or read. Now, that's an excellent goal, to work to move more good words into our speaking vocabulary, to gain confidence in using a greater variety of words while still being understandable and reaching those that we're speaking to. Then Mr. Armstrong started to study writing style. He said, immediately, I set out to develop a distinct and effective style. It had to be fast-moving, vigorous, yet simple, interesting, making the message plain and understandable. Now, if you've heard Mr. Armstrong speak or you've read his material, you know he was plain and understandable, but he also used a rich vocabulary in a dynamic, elevated way. And he made the subjects that he wrote and spoke about not only easy to understand, but also forceful and vibrant. Winston Churchill was another tremendous example of an orator and a writer. He wrote an essay called The Scaffolding of Rhetoric, in which he said, there is no more important element in the technique of rhetoric than the continual employment of the best possible word. Now, often the best possible word isn't the first word that comes to mind. That's where a thesaurus or some similar tool can come in handy, using a website like thesaurus.com. But it's not just using a more complicated word. It has to be the right word, the best word. Churchill was another excellent example of deploying a rich vocabulary of common words. I want to read a famous section of a speech that he gave on June 18th, 1940, before the House of Commons. Now, virtually all the words that he uses are well known. Most of them are one or two syllables, but there's a great variety, and they're put together in a forceful, vivid way. What General Weygand called the Battle of France is over. I expect that the Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. If we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duties and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say this was their finest hour. So in that whole excerpt of that speech, these are the only words that were three or more syllables: survival, civilization, enemy, including, sinister, protracted — that's probably the only uncommon word — perverted, and Commonwealth. Almost everything else was one syllable. Now, imagine Churchill saying the same thing with a less varied, less interesting, more mundane vocabulary. What General Weygand called the Battle of France is over. I'm pretty sure the Battle of Britain is coming. Now, this could have a huge impact. In fact, if we lose, Britain might not make it. Like, it's about to get really tough. The Germans are pretty nasty, and they're coming for us. Hitler knows he has to beat us, or he'll lose the war. If we beat him, we can save Europe. We might even make the world a better place. But if we lose, things are going to get a lot harder. And I mean a lot harder, especially when you look at some of the things scientists are doing these days. So let's dig in and get to work. Let's win. So someday, maybe our children will say, thanks, Dad. Mr. Armstrong gave a lot of thought to how he expressed his thoughts. And he established a public speaking program called Spokesman Club that puts a lot of emphasis on this. In the manual for that club, he wrote, strive for certain goals in speaking. Work to build a good-sized vocabulary so the exact words will always be at the tip of your tongue to say what you have in mind to say and to make it plain and understandable. And he dedicated a page in the club manual to this point called Increase Your Word Power. He gave five potent practical action steps to be word conscious when you're reading and you find words that you're not familiar with, and then use them. Read widely, it says, and cultivate the habit of spotting new words in your reading and listening. Get the dictionary habit. When you find a word you don't know, look it up and spend a little time with it, and then use that word. Force yourself to use it in conversation. Set a goal for yourself to use those words and incorporate them into your writing and your speaking. Spend a little time saying the words that you learn and move them from your reading vocabulary to your speaking vocabulary. Drop them into your conversation with your friends or your family a few times. It might feel a little awkward at first, but it's like breaking in a pair of new shoes. You'll soon feel comfortable with them. Build a robust vocabulary as a means of building robust thinking. Elevated language represents elevated thought. So ennoble your language, and you'll ennoble your thinking and your life. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Dennis Leap, York Mardian, and Richard Palmer. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Lord Halifax. True merit, like a river, the deeper it is, the less noise it makes. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.